From KUNC, this is Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. As of this morning, there is one less presidential candidate from Colorado running in the 2020 race. Former Governor John Hickenlooper ended his bid for the Democratic nomination in a three-minute video that came out late this morning.
Sitting on the steps of a porch with an American flag in the background, Hickenlooper reiterated some of the reasons why he got into the race. He thanked his family and donors, and at the end, left the door open for his political future.
I've heard from so many Coloradans who want me to run for the United States Senate. They remind me how much is at stake for our country and our state. I intend to give that some serious thought.
With more on today's news and why Hickenlooper failed to gain momentum, we're joined by KUNC's Matt Bloom, who back in March reported on his entry to the race. Hi, Matt.
Hey.
Back then, the big question was kind of whether Hickenlooper would stay true to who he is, a former brewpub owner and geologist with kind of an unscripted approach to politics.
Right. I mean, this is the guy who won elections for Denver mayor and governor with these goofy political ads that were meant to make him seem more relatable. I talked to Seth Maskett about this. He's the director of the Center on American Politics at the University of Denver.
You know, his kind of quirky approach to politics, which has served him pretty well within Colorado, just seemed very out of place on the national stage. He didn't look or sound like most of the people on the stage, and not necessarily in a way that advantaged him there. He seemed kind of out of his role.
So the answer to this question that a lot of people had back in March was that, yes, he did stay true to his style. And as we now know, it did not work out in his favor.
As he stated in his video, his political career may not be totally over. A lot of people have been urging him to run against Republican Senator Cory Gardner. And some have said he kind of should have been doing this from the first place, the Senate race thing.
Well, there's still a lot of hope from Democrats that he'll make a run for the Senate. There are recent polls that have given him a huge advantage over Cory Gardner. They say that he could potentially win by double digits, which is way higher than he ever polled for president. I asked Maskett about this, too.
I mean, the main thing he has is enormous name recognition. He's just been a household name within Colorado for, you know, well over a decade. He's a known quantity. He's proven he can win statewide, even in 2010 and 2014, which were not very good years for Democrats in the state. He managed to win quite comfortably. And he'd probably be, you know, in a much stronger position in 2020.
Hickenlooper isn't the only politician from Colorado running for president. Democratic Senator Michael Bennett is still in the race. And in an emailed statement today, he thanked Hickenlooper for his contributions to the 2020 race. How does Hickenlooper dropping out affect Bennett's chances?
Even though Bennett entered a lot later than Hickenlooper did, his debate performances have gained a lot more attention. The two were some of the more moderate voices among the other candidates. And now that Hickenlooper's out, Maskett says Bennett could benefit from that.
The people who have been backing Hickenlooper, I think, have shared his concern about the leftward drift of the party and have wanted to sort of push back against what they see as progressivism or socialism, and want to back, you know, someone who seems more moderate, maybe seems like, they have a better shot at getting elected. My impression is that, you know, Bennett can capture that as well.
That being said, there are only a few more weeks to qualify for the next Democratic debates in September, and Bennett still has not met the polling or the donor threshold for that.
All right, Matt, thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
And speaking of the donor threshold, we had one other question now that Hickenlooper isn't in the race for president. What happens to all that money that he raised but didn't spend? KUNC's Michael DeJoanna has been looking into that very question, and he joins us now with what he's found out about that. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Erin.
So there is a lot of money. We're talking a lot, hundreds of millions of dollars
right,
flowing into campaign accounts for all of the presidential hopefuls. That includes the incumbent.
Right. That's right. President Donald Trump, as you referenced, has raised $124 million for his 2020 reelection bid. Democrat Bernie Sanders has raised $46 million, and Elizabeth Warren, $35 million. Those are big bucks.
Indeed. And so what about John Hickenlooper? How is he doing with fundraising?
Well, he brought in a little over $3 million, so not as much, but a big chunk of that money has already been spent. The latest information available from the FEC, that's the Federal Election Commission, which tracks candidate funds, says he still has about $836,000 on hand.
What happens to that money? Will it be refunded to donors?
You know, Aaron, that's a question for his campaign, and I've reached out to them, but I haven't heard back yet. Meanwhile, here's what the campaign could do. It could issue some refunds, or money could go to pay out any outstanding bills. And there's another option. As Hickenlooper said today, he's seriously considering a Senate run. I reached out to Michael Beckel. He's with the D.C. nonprofit campaign finance watchdog group Issue One. And I asked him if Hickenlooper could roll his money into a Senate campaign.
Broadly speaking, any money that Hickenlooper raised for his presidential campaign, he could use for a Senate bid should he go down that road.
Interesting, especially since the Democratic field in the Senate race is just about as crowded as the push to replace President Trump.
Yes. According to the FEC, there's already 16 Democrats hoping to challenge Republican Cory Gardner next year.
Republicans, obviously, are trying to protect their embattled incumbents and maintain their majority in the U.S. Senate. So the Colorado Senate race is likely going to be one of the most contentious in the country.
So Gardner has already raised $6.6 million. Roughly the same amount is spread among all the Democratic contenders, with Michael Johnston, who ran for governor in 2018, with the most. He's got $3.3 million.
Now, we heard earlier from KUNC reporter Matt Bloom that Hickenlooper would be a strong candidate if he joined the race. And you're saying he would have a good start financially with a run if he was able to roll his presidential campaign money into the election?
Possibly. Also consider what I reported last week. Despite Hickenlooper's low poll numbers, he was attracting a lot more super PAC money in the presidential race than most Democrats.
Those are the political action committees that can accept unlimited amounts of money.
Exactly. And their donors tend to be rich and can transform a political race. There's one called Share Purpose PAC, and it's raised $575,000 from a short list that includes Walmart heir Christy Walton and three executives at Colorado's Liberty Media. None of those funds have been spent, and if the donors want, they could get refunds, give to another presidential candidate.
Or maybe use it to back Hickenlooper's run for Senate.
Exactly. If he makes that decision, and that seems to be the money he'd need to hit the ground running. I should say I reached out to Shared Purpose, but I haven't heard back yet.
Michael DeJoanna is an investigative reporter for KUNC. He's been looking into what happens with the money former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper raised for his 2020 presidential bid that he ended today.
We reached out to the state Democratic Party for a reaction to Hickenlooper leaving the door open for a possible Senate run, and we received a statement from their communications advisor, Alyssa Roberts. It said, quote, "Our Democratic nominee will be in a strong position to beat Cory Gardner, who's made himself the most vulnerable Republican in the nation by voting with Trump and wealthy special interests over Coloradans' health care, environment, and economic security."
This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.
When Colorado voters legalized recreational marijuana in 2012, advocates said it would wipe out the underworld of drug dealers. But in the past few months, Fort Collins police have seized hundreds of illegally grown marijuana plants. As KUNC's Esther Honig reports, the black market is now so big, it's stealing business from legal cannabis sellers.
Scott Brady quickly slides open a heavy wooden door leading to his greenhouse. Inside are bright lights, whirring fans.
So these ones right here, they'll all be coming down tomorrow.
And dozens of marijuana plants, heavy with big green buds.
It almost makes your mouth start to water and such. It looks so good, right? That's that bag appeal we're looking for.
Brady manages Smokies 420, a dispensary and grow house in Weld County. The company has spent years perfecting their growing technique, like using beneficial insects instead of harsh chemicals.
So it became very important for us to really embrace creating the most natural, most compliant product that we could.
With more dispensaries in Colorado than Starbucks and McDonald's combined, Brady says it's important that Smokies stand out among the competition. But there's one competitor they can't beat back so easily.
Each time somebody in the black market sells a gram, they're taking it right out of my people's pockets at the end of the day.
Without all the state regulations like product testing, licensing, and a 15% tax, illegal marijuana growers have an economic advantage. George Brockler is the attorney for Colorado's 18th Judicial District.
Look, I've only been doing this for 25 years, and I have never seen the black market as robust and as complicated and as expertly cultivated as this one right now.
It's hard to say just how big the illegal market is, but Brockler points to the growing number of cases his office sees. There's been 51 this year, including one of the biggest on record, where 80,000 plants were seized, worth potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars. And these massive operations hide in quiet suburbs.
These guys will go out into these neighborhoods in a way we've never seen before, either rent or buy for cash. Sometimes they do it with the wink, wink, nudge, nudge of the homeowner. And they will turn these things into very quickly into these very professional, high-grade grows.
The end product is typically transported to states like Florida and Texas, where Colorado weed has its own brand recognition and sells for 3 to 4 times the local price. It's a lucrative gig.
Who wouldn't do that all day long? That beats driving for Domino's. That beats Uber.
So what's the most effective way to thwart the illegal market? Brockler says more states could choose to legalize marijuana, and he's not alone in that opinion.
The biggest threat, I think, is also a positive thing, and I think it's legalization.
That's Lloyd. We're using his middle name to conceal his identity because he spent the last 14 years working in the illegal marijuana market.
I'd like to think of myself as a concierge.
He says he puts illegal growers in Colorado in touch with buyers, mainly in the Bible Belt.
Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, anywhere where marijuana is not tolerated at all is where usually the price is going to be the highest.
Colorado, he says, is a trafficker's dream for its central location. But even now, as more states legalize, there are 11 plus the District of Columbia. Lloyd says it's become less profitable than it once was.
And I've seen a lot of my peers have to actually, you know, succumb to getting a 9-to-5.
But it's not harmless. The Drug Enforcement Agency stresses that the state's illegal marijuana market is often linked to more nefarious criminal organizations. Lloyd, for example, currently faces human trafficking charges.
I don't think those guys understand the damage that they do to our industry.
Back inside a legal marijuana grow, Scott Brady says people like Lloyd give legitimate businesses like his a bad reputation, and they divert sales because illegal weed is also sold in Colorado.
If people can go next door and get it from somebody else for same price or maybe even cheaper, they're going to do that.
Last year, legal marijuana sales in Colorado hit $1.5 billion. And if it weren't for the black market, it might have been even more. Esther Honig, KUNC.
Henry, you like to run, don't you?
Like is a strong word.
Okay, I get that. Now, imagine running 100 miles.
I can barely imagine running one.
I am right there with you. Imagine running 100 miles at 10,000 feet above sea level. That's what runners at this weekend's Leadville Trail 100 can expect. But that doesn't stop hundreds from competing. And this race isn't just famous for its grueling nature. It's also known for how it helped transform its hometown of Leadville, Colorado. Joining us now to discuss the race is its founder, Ken Klober. Ken, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. I appreciate getting the opportunity to tell the Leadville Trail 100 story.
This is a great story. Now, you used to work in the mines in Leadville, and then...
In fact, our whole town did, and that's the genesis of the Leadville Trail 100.
Tell us the story.
I was an underground shift boss at the mine. Loved it. Every day I'd go 600 feet straight down and about a mile, a little better back underneath that mountain and go to work. Went to work one swing shift, and we got all ready to go underground. The crew got ready and started to get on the lift to go underground, and got a phone call from the mine boss and wanted all the shift bosses to come up the office. We jumped in pickups and ran up there, and it was a very short meeting. He said, "We're closing the mine. Go back, tell your crews to go home. Their unions will be in contact with them tomorrow. You go home. Management hands will be in contact with you tomorrow." Mm. And that was it. We lost 3,250 jobs that night. And in a community of 5,000, that was everybody, everybody. We were the highest unemployment in the nation, just with one mine closing. So.
And I bet that was devastating for the whole community.
Oh, it was. It was. Because we not only lost our income, we lost our identity. No longer we're miners. We're just out on the street. Well, our community got together. We knew we had to do something. We had to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. Critical ingredient was Governor Lamb. He came down to our community then and talked to us. We formed a little committee, the Leadville Improvement Group, and he talked to us and he said, to save your town, you got to bring people in to spend money. And you got to save your schools and you got to save your hospitals. If you don't save your school and your hospital, then you're headed for ghost town.
Okay.
He said, the key to getting people to spend money when they come to your town is that they stay overnight. And that was the trip trigger. We were all looking for reasons to get people to come to our town to stay overnight. We had suggestions for all kind of different events and fairs and whatever, and a suggestion of various length of foot races. And then I had been involved just in some longer races, marathons, and even a 50-mile race.
Okay.
And so the numbers, getting people to stay overnight in our town, one little unnecessary stoplight at 10,200 feet. All those zeros just resonated with us. And so I decided, well, if they come here to run 100 miles, they're doggone sure going to stay overnight.
Because that takes a little while.
Yeah.
Right.
So we had our first race in 1983, and it just grew and grew from there. The real boost to us came in 1985, and television got a hold of it.
Ah.
Wide World of Sports, NBC Sports World.
Right.
And from that point on, we had more people signing up, that wanted to sign up for the race than what we thought we could handle. So
that's a great thing.
It's been a success for our community ever since. It's always been about what we could give, not what we could get.
Mm-hmm.
Turn that money around to our community. And then bottom line, we're changing life too. We're bringing people here from all over the world and teaching them how to be Leadville tough.
Yeah. Now, you yourself have run the Leadville 100 a number of times. I mean, what is it like to do that at that altitude?
You know, this is something coming from our mining background. When I started this 100-mile race in underground mining, you never wanted to ask anybody on your crew to do anything, to crawl in any hole or light any amount of dynamite that you weren't willing to put yourself on the line for. So, yes, started running those races from the very first one. I paid my entry fee just like everybody else, and I managed to finish 14 of them, 14 100 Leadville Trail 100. So I've got my 1,000-mile buckle that I proudly wear.
Now, do you have any advice then for runners competing this year, maybe who want to win that buckle?
Absolutely. We can do, and this is the best thing we're doing. We're sharing Leadville grit, guts, and determination with the people that visit our community. And we tell them, if you're tough enough, you've got to believe in one thing. You've got to believe in yourself. Because if you don't believe in yourself, nobody else is going to believe in you. So when that starting gun goes off, you just don't quit from that point on. You just keep going. And that's the secret to success in life anyway, is persistence. You don't give up. You just don't give up. So people learn that they're better than they think they are, and they can do more than they think they can. And it, in fact, once they cross that finish line, it changes lives, because they can take that new level of confidence with them and share that at home with their families, at their job, with their communities. And so we send a little bit of Leadville all over the world.
Ken Klober is the founder of the Leadville 100. The race takes place this weekend, beginning at 4 a.m. on Saturday morning.
I can still get you in there.
I'll have to see about that.
Okay.
Ken, thank you so much for sharing the story with us. This was amazing.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Whether or not the old adage about walking a mile in someone else's shoes is really true, a new exhibition at this year's Biennial of the Americas is testing the theory. KUNC arts reporter Stacey Nick has the story.
there's a giant shoebox on Denver's 16th Street Mall across from Union Station. Inside are more than 30 pairs of shoes, along with the recorded stories from those who walked in them.
My name is Theo, short for Theobald. Theobald is a very old English name that my great-grandfather had because he was a descendant of Jamaican slaves.
I'm a mom. I'm a state representative. I'm a wife. And I'm a friend, I hope.
When I was 2 years old, my left leg was amputated below the knee because I had a condition called fibular hemimelia.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it's like to be me through a very interesting story. And that is the story of how I forgot most of my life.
That's Black Actors Guild co-founder Ryan Fu, triathlete Emily Harvey, Colorado Representative Daphna Michelson-Janay, and spoken word artist Theo Wilson. The project is part of the Biennial of the Americas Festival exhibit, A Mile in My Shoes, where you can literally try on someone else's shoes.
I know some people might be skittish about putting on someone else's shoes, but part of empathy is really, in some cases, feeling uncomfortable.
That's Executive Director Aaron Trapp.
If you haven't ever worked construction for a living, wearing the footwear of someone who does can really put you in that mind space and help you understand what they're going through.
So I asked Trapp to take off her strappy sandals and put on a scuffed pair of men's work boots.
Come on. There we go.
All right.
How do they feel?
They feel roomy. It is hard to imagine working outdoors in these all summer long because they're so constraining. You know, I'm used to wearing sandals. My feet get to breathe a little, but I guess you don't if you are working on a project. They feel kind of like blocks of cement.
These are the boots of Theo Wilson. In his story, Wilson, who is black, tells of a frightening encounter with the police.
Four police officers swarmed me and stood me up. And in the melee of the crowd, I knew that they didn't see this, so my last weapon was my voice. I began to yell and scream, "Police brutality, police brutality, police brutality." And they all began to turn around.
The event was a crossroads for Wilson, who went on to become a spoken word artist.
The power that I had in the moments before was my voice. And in my voice, I found my power. I realized that what I needed to do was use it in order to change my destiny. And that's exactly what I did.
The idea for this exhibit, part of British artist Claire Patty's Empathy Museum, is that listening to someone's story while putting yourself in their place builds empathy and understanding. Each story is around 12 minutes long, about the same amount of time it would take someone to walk a mile, Trapp says. There's a wide variety of stories and shoes, from the glittery spike heels of a drag queen to the sensible wedges of a working mom.
The ones that really touched me were some of the stories that were people completely different from me, who I literally probably never have interacted with in a significant way. To hear the story of someone, you know, who recovered from a car accident and how that affected their life and transformed their lives.
Although actually walking in another person's shoes isn't always easy, as we learn when we get to Emily Harvey and the sneakers she wore to complete an Ironman triathlon last year. It's attached to a colorful prosthetic leg.
Growing up, I played sports. I played t-ball. I played volleyball. I played golf. I rode horses. And, you know, we always just found a way to make it work for me. And my mom always encouraged me to ask how instead of if.
Now, how are people going to do the prosthetic?
You know, maybe I think one idea would be to use straps around the prosthetic so that you could just have an idea.
And that's exactly what you hear at the end of Harvey's story.
As a person with a disability, a visible disability, I've been given a gift to be able to share with the world my idea that you can do more than you think you can.
And to do that, sometimes you have to step out of your comfort zone and into someone else's shoes and see if that shoe fits. Stacey Nick, KUNC, Denver.
And that's our show for today. We'll be back on Monday with a look at a contentious recall campaign happening in Estes Park. Colorado Edition is hosted by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Henry Zimmerman. Lily Tyson is our producer.
Special thanks to Brian Larson, Catherine Welch, Esther Honig, Stacey Nick, Michael DeJuana, and Matt Bloom, who all contributed to today's show.
And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us Monday for another episode of Colorado Edition.